This is the Blacklist Podcast. I'm Franklin Leonard, one half of your hosting duo.
And I'm Kate Hagen, the other half of your hosting duo.
And we have a really fun conversation today. Our guest is an activist, the New York Times bestselling author of We're Gonna Need More Wine. She has a new children's book called Welcome to the Party. She's an actor, and you may also know her as the captain of the East Compton Clovers cheerleading squad in the movie Bring It On. That's right. We have Gabrielle Union here today.
We're going to kick off the conversation by taking it all the way back to Bring It On and talk about some of the great teen films of that era. Then we're going to talk about some of Gabrielle's favorite movies, which range from Grease to Grease 2. And then we're going to bring the conversation contemporary, talking a bit about the evolving American family and how we consume media and content. We're going to talk to Gabrielle about how she shares content with her family, what movies they're watching, and how they navigate some of those difficult conversations around media. It's a really great conversation.
She really is about that life. That comes up too. Enjoy. Here's Kate and I with Gabrielle Union.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
We love to open up every conversation by asking the same question, which is that, can you remember the first movie you ever saw in a movie theater?
In a movie theater? Oof.
And you want to set the scene for us. It doesn't have to be the first movie you saw in a theater, but like, what's your first memory of going to see a movie in a movie theater?
Because I certainly don't remember the first one I would have seen. Geez, that is a great question. And I don't know why this one's coming up, but
great. That's all we need. That's all we need is the one that like first comes up.
So it had to have been after the Los Angeles Olympics, and Mitch Gaylord did a gymnastics movie that starred Jenny Jones, who was a dancer that I don't know if you guys remember from the movie A Chorus Line, and she went on to marry this hockey guy. Maybe his name was Wayne Gretzky. But anyway, they were the stars of this gymnastics movie. And I remember going to see it at the one theater that we had really at the time in Dublin, up in the Bay Area. And I feel like it was probably packed. And I went with my group of junior high friends.
Yeah, the movie you're referring to is American Anthem.
There we go.
American Anthem, a sports drama. The subject of the film was a football player turned gymnast seeking to join the United States Olympic team. And Mitch Gaylord, gold medal U.S. men's gymnastics in the 84 Summer Olympics. And yes, Janet Jones, eventual wife of Wayne Gretzky.
That is amazing,
actually.
What year was that?
This was 1986.
86. So that was seventh grade. And it was probably one of the only times I got to go to the movies, or one of the first times I got to go to the movies by myself, like, or, you know, with my friends versus like a parent having to come with us.
Here's what's also amazing is that was Albert Magnoli's follow-up to the movie Purple Rain.
No.
That movie was directed by the director of Purple Rain 2 years after he did Purple Rain.
I don't even know how to feel about that.
Same, honestly. And he was also briefly Prince's manager. I'm just reading the Wikipedia page now, but this is a discovery, to be sure.
all from the random, and I believe this was Mitch Gaylord's like opening and closing, right? I don't think he had like a career in the cinema after this.
I don't believe so. Well, actually, he was the stunt double for Chris O'Donnell as Robin in the 1995 movie Batman Forever.
No way.
That
really?
Was the other, and he currently works as a financial advisor at Morgan Stanley. What?
What a life.
A remarkable life.
That's an amazing trajectory.
That is, wow, this is a heck of an opening to this conversation. I did not really see it going this way. Wait, but you mentioned the Bay Area, because yes. I think of you as being from Nebraska.
Yes, yes. I'm originally from Omaha, Nebraska, and my parents got transferred to the Bay Area in the early 80s, in 81. And we moved to Pleasanton, which I rarely admit. I usually just say East Bay, and because, you know, racism, well, people generally assume I mean Oakland.
That's how people from the Bay are, basically.
You know, and I let them. I don't generally correct them. I'm like, yes. Yes.
You know.
The vague Bay Area, East Bay. No one ever asks, could it be Pleasanton?
You're letting people assume you're from Oakland. I'm not, like, it's fine.
I'm fully okay with that.
Yeah. Yep. That's, I wish I had anything in my bio that would allow me to do that. Okay, so first movie you saw in a theater, American Anthem. Second question is, what was the movie that made you fall in love with movies? That made you say, like, oh, this is what I want to do?
Well, see, the movie that I've been obsessed with my whole life from a very young age is one of the first movies I remember seeing repeatedly was Grease. And being drawn to Cha-Cha de Gregorio, the best dancer at St. Bernadette's with the worst reputation, and Rizzo. I never wanted to be Sandy, never wanted to be, you know, brush up. Like, I didn't want to be like that friend. I wanted to be, if I wasn't going to get to be, you know, Sandy, give me Rizzo any fucking day, or Cha-Cha. I've always been drawn to, the cooler, less girl next door type of characters. Not that I've got to play them that often, but.
Well, do you feel like those characters were the first time you saw yourself on screen? Like, we often ask people, like, what is the first time you saw yourself on screen? But like, was that the moment, or was there another moment, or do you feel like you ever, talk to us about that.
Thinking about like what I was watching in my childhood, no. The first time I really felt like, oh, black people, was when Janet Jackson was on Different Strokes as Charlene, and Tootie on Facts of Life. There just really wasn't a lot. Tisha Campbell had that show that I think lasted like, I don't even feel like it went a whole season, but it was like Rags to Riches, where she went from rags to riches and she becomes a I don't know if it was an actor or an entertainer. But there just really weren't. The fact that I could name you those few.
Right.
And by the time high school rolled around, when Vivica Fox was cast, she had an arc on 90210 as the Popcorn King's daughter. And Brandon kind of maybe was attracted to her. And I was like, yes, we in this bitch. But there just really wasn't. Like, because Sparkle wasn't, I remember seeing Sparkle and more so the music. But in terms of someone who had hair like mine and skin like mine and who got to be the object of affection and a lead, we just didn't have a ton. And I'm really thinking hard right now in TV. We didn't have anything. So I had to see myself in the people who were sort of off center, if that makes sense. You know, I grew up kind of being in the popular crowd. I had this bird's eye view of what it was like to be, you know, the center of the universe, but not being center of the universe. This outsider insider view, which kind of sums up my time in Hollywood. Close enough to see how it's actually working, but not really getting to enjoy all the spoils. Like Rizzo.
Yeah.
She starts fucking, she gets pregnant. It's like, God, dang it. You know, the school turns on her.
I'm glad we're talking about teen movies, because I have to take it all the way back to the first movie I ever saw you in, which was Bring It On. And I have to say, Gabrielle, you're in like the perfect quadrilogy of teen movies from that era. Bring It On, She's All That, 10 Things I Hate About You, and Love and Basketball. And I think the reason those movies have stood the test of time is that they're all sort of deceptive in presenting themselves as, you know, oh, it's a fun teen movie, but they're actually about some really interesting themes. So I was wondering what it was like to read Bring It On for the first time and realize it was delving into these deeper themes around cultural appropriation, how we value certain people's art, and how we get into these like really complex teenage girl dynamics.
That is a great question, in that the first reading of Bring It On, I read at home before this table read that they'd put together. And my husband at the time was more proficient in Ebonics than I, though I thought I was pretty proficient. So I kept coming across this word, and this word, it just looked like a bunch of letters, because it wasn't a word I recognized. And I was like, I don't understand what this is. Like, read this and tell me what it is that you see, because I'm not getting a word. I don't even understand what sound this is supposed to be. And so he's studying it, looking at it, and he was like, wow, they really tried to write this out. And I was like, what? Tell me. And he said, what they want you to say is, oh, say what it was. Like how Martin would say that on the Martin Show. Like, oh, say what it was. So imagine how that might be spelled out.
Wow.
And there was a lot of that. There was a line that said, meow, me gonna ow you. My nails are long, sharp, and ready to slash. These were actual things that they wanted ISIS to say. So while, yes, we were going to be talking about cultural appropriation, the path to this iconic movie was not as smooth as you would have thought, given how the movie has you know, stood the test of time and how is always sort of held up as this kind of beacon of light that was sort of subversive before its time. And yes, it was that too, but trying to explain from a place of zero power why these things were problematic was a challenge. So I remember going to the table read, and they had different actors come in and reading the parts. And I think it might have been like maybe one or two other people who went on to actually be in the movie. Because I remember Ethan Embry was at the table read. That's one of the only other people I remember being at that table read, doing Jesse Bradford's role. And I was like, I have to say these things so they know that it's bad. Like, this is not good. Right. We will be picketed if I say this. But yeah, that was like really one of the first times in my career where I was presented with this amazing opportunity that was kind of cringy and problematic, and having to try to figure out how do I, in what tone and in what way do I explain that this is wildly problematic and I'm not going to say this, but I do want this amazing opportunity. And I just lucked out that Peyton was like, oh, yes, thank you, Gab. You're absolutely correct. We will change all of this.
But it sounds like you didn't say this is a problem. It sounded like you went in and intentionally like sort of laid bare how ridiculous it was, rather than saying, hey, guys, this is ridiculous.
Yeah. So I went, by the way, I thought, like, if I give them what they've actually written and do it in a way that is undeniably cringy, maybe they will see and make the changes on their own, as opposed to I have to basically risk this opportunity by letting these powerful people know that I have a problem with these words. And a lot of people would have a problem with these words as written. And then after the table read, they asked me, they straight up asked me, and I was like, oh, Jesus. And we're all faced, a lot of us are faced with this moment of like, I thought I had idiot-proofed this, but I have to now back this all up with explaining page by page where we have to make these changes.
Yeah, I was going to say, because the risk you run is them coming to you and being like, Gabrielle, this was amazing. Exactly, yeah. Exactly that in the movie. We're done
do
here.
Do that.
Yeah. And I've seen things like that happen before. So I wonder, like, managing that fear has got to be stressful. And I'm sure it's also not the only time that you've had to engage in that sort of negotiation throughout your career.
No, I mean, it's ongoing. It's never stopped. Yeah. I wish it had hit a peak in, like, you know, the early 2000s. It did not. No, this has been an ongoing thing. And it's a gamble every time, just because you are the person that's, like, armed or tasked with the responsibility of delivering the hard truths doesn't mean they're always going to be grateful for it or act on it. A lot of times they're like, thank you and goodbye. And that's just the reality.
The flip of this is obviously, I mean, look, it's become a cliche joke at this point that you have not aged in the last several decades. But the flip of this is that you have now been around long enough that you have characters like ISIS who are the first time people are seeing themselves on screen. I mean, literally, the most recent episode of Insecure, dressed as ISIS. What's that like for you? That character specifically, but just in general, this notion that the first time people are seeing themselves on screen is a role that you are playing and you are still here and looking roughly their age. But you know the point I'm making.
Yeah. No, it's wild. Because we all, you know, got that movie or took that movie kind of as like a consolation prize. You know, the cheerleading movie I wanted was I think it was called Sugar and Spice. It's about bank robbing cheerleaders. And there was, like, I don't know, a gang of them. I don't know, like 10, 12. It was a whole bunch of cheerleaders. And not one of them could be Black. They decided, not a one. Like, and I was crushed because I thought that was the cheerleading movie that was going to stand the test of time and, you know, blah, blah, blah. So when they were, you know, I was presented with this table read and then, like, oh God, do I speak up? Because I've already lost, you know, this job or this, you know, the job that I wanted. So being tasked with this table read with Bring It On, it was like, God, do I tell the truth about, you know, some of these words, but let me go for it. So knowing everything that went into who got those parts, why they took those jobs or got those jobs, it feels really good to know that it's still resonating and it still means something, that ISIS means something, and that all those fights and all those uncomfortable conversations created a character that people still are like, yes. And knowing that it's one of those badass motherfuckers that just doesn't take shit. And she's a leader and she's willing to sort of risk it all to stand up for what's right. And that is a character that people are still fucking with after all of this time feels amazing.
I feel like it's a really special space when you get to the point where, you know, there is a Halloween costume of a character you've played. That's a very rare sort of space for actors.
Yeah, like, and not only a Halloween costume, like a mass-produced Halloween costume that you literally see multiple times every year, everywhere you go.
I tried to get it for my birthday this year, my original Clover uniform from Universal. They did not give it to me. So we had to.
Wait, hang on. They didn't.
Okay, Universal.
They didn't give it to you as in they still have it and refused? Or they were just like, sorry, we don't know where it is?
No, they have it. They would not give it up. Would not give it up. I don't even know if it would fit, to be honest.
Put it in the Black Smithsonian. That's my personal. but seriously, though, I would argue that actual costume belongs in the Blacksonian. Anyway, Kate, take us to the next phase.
We're going to pivot it back to the questionnaire a little bit. Another question that we love to ask everyone. What is your ideal way to watch movies, whether that's going to a movie theater, which we would all love to be doing right now, or in your home? Do you like watching movies by yourself? Do you like having snacks, silence? What's the vibe?
So I don't know if this is weird or anyone else has responded this way. I prefer watching movies on a plane. Because I've lived on a plane and it's my time to completely zone out, you know, put my headphones on, whatever snacks the plane has available. damn people and their peanut allergies and their nut allergies, because I love some warm nuts. But alas, that those days are gone. But yeah, I just like watching, you know, screeners, you know, when, since I've been able to have those, just watching them on the plane. And I bring my DVD player so I can like watch my screeners. I feel like it's the best time for me to be able to focus, have my alone time. Yeah. And I can actually really pay attention, and I'm grateful for the time versus in a theater where you have to contend with other people. I can't deal with fidgeting. It's a thing. I can't do it. And I live with some fidgeters, so I tend to not love watching movies at home or in the movie theater.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Follow up on the plane movies question. Something that has come up a couple times on the podcast so far is, do you find yourself to be a movie crier on airplanes more so? This is something we're finding as we talk to folks.
I don't know why. I mean, I'm an emotional, you know, content watcher, whether it be a podcast or, you know, an Oscar winning film. I cry. I like the snotty cry. Yeah, it's bad. Like I don't, it's like I'm in my own pod, even though I'm not. And I'm waiting for that day when somebody's like, you know, low key recording me watching a movie. Cause you'll see snot. I'm just going to tell you now. I'm way more locked in and way more emotionally connected. So whatever that emotion is, you're going to see it on that plane.
It keeps coming up in these conversations, the plane thing, because of the sort of hyper emotionality, but also because I think it's a place where people do feel it's a release. It's like, okay, I can do this now and not worry about anybody else or a phone call or anything because I'm 30,000 feet above the ground.
I find it bizarre, and mainly because it's like I've spent all this money to go to a theater to watch a movie. I'm watching the movie. I want to be still. I want quiet. I don't want to see, like, I don't want to hear pings on your phone or your phone going off. I don't want to see the glow of people on their phone watching a movie. Like, it's so wildly disrespectful to me. I don't know. But I hate it, and it's distracting. I cannot stand it.
I will say the other thing that weirdly is a pet peeve of mine, and I've started seeing this more often back when we could go to the movies, is people just taking screenshots of a movie, like not videoing it, right? Like they're not trying to make money by selling a pirated copy. They're just like taking single images, and I'm just thinking, like, what are you doing with these? I don't know. Maybe I lack the creativity.
You post them, and you say, at the movies.
Maybe, but then you inevitably get a follow-up, a cease and desist order from the studio or whatever because you posted an image from a film that they own. Like, it's one thing if you're like, okay, let me post a photo of, like, you know, the lights getting dark or the theater. But to actually post a photo of, you know, T'Challa, it just doesn't make any sense. Anyway, I've clearly moved into uncle zone where I'm just complaining about everything.
No, this is the only time I will consent to being called an auntie, but this is like, I cannot stand it. I hate it. Yeah. I hate the rustling in a purse or a satchel. Yeah. I can't stand it.
I'm with you. I'm 100% with you.
That just makes me think of that. There's a great gif that goes around a film Twitter of Isabelle Huppert being like, absolute silence, no snacks, no movement. That's the only way to watch a movie. You guys are in great company. Speaking of things sort of in the canon, are there any movies in the overall sort of great movies that everyone is expected to have seen canon that you still sort of refuse to watch?
Yeah, and it's so embarrassing, and I hate telling people this because the reaction is like, I'm going to be kicked out.
This is why we asked the question.
I'm going to be kicked out of Hollywood.
We are removing the stigma. This is literally why we asked the question.
I've probably seen combined about 15 minutes of all three of The Godfathers.
That's fine. You're allowed. Yeah, we're all allowed. Coming clean on this podcast. That answer is more common than you would think. I have a number of friends who put off watching Godfathers forever, so you're certainly not alone.
Yeah. But I have seen everything Christy McNichol has been in, so I feel like it's about the same.
Are there movies that you resisted watching, like The Godfather, that eventually you were just like, okay, fine, let me watch this, and you were just like, y'all, why didn't you tell me? And everybody in your life was like, we did.
Oh,
this is on you.
Like, probably Scarface, I watched like 2 years ago. And I'm like, oh my God, you guys, this is where that line comes from. And they're like, yeah, no shit, you fucking weirdo.
Literally. Every single black person alive is like, yeah, we have all been saying this is a very good movie.
Yeah.
Literally every rapper, every...
I was late. I was late to the party.
No, it's...
But I've seen literally...
I have a list. I have my own list. We talked about it. There will be more. I totally get it.
But I watch all YA.
Well, here's the other thing. Everybody has their list because it's not possible to watch it all. The difference is whether you're honest about your list. And that is the key. The honesty is the differentiator, not whether you've seen all of the good movies.
Yeah. Like when I told Michael Ealy this when we first started doing Being Mary Jane, and he, to this day, he'll randomly text me, I still can't believe you haven't seen the Godfathers. And then I told Omar Epps when we were doing... Almost Christmas, and he's just in disbelief. Like they just can't believe it. I don't know if it's an East Coast thing or what, but like,
it's not an East Coast thing. I mean, maybe, but I don't think so.
But I feel like people think less of me now. Like they lost something.
That's their failure as a human being. It's not.
I bet there are great movies you have seen that they have not seen. So how about that?
Probably all of the Christy McNichol movies.
Exactly. Fun flip on that question.
Yeah, I was going to say, speaking of which.
What is a terrible movie? We're talking like less than 25% on Rotten Tomatoes that you will defend forever.
Okay, here's another thing. I've never gone on Rotten Tomatoes.
Yes.
I get it. Like, I want people to like the things that I do, but I'm not going to, I cannot clock watch people's. I can't.
It's healthy. This is the healthy approach.
I can't. I've never been on Rotten Tomatoes, so I don't know how low it is, but when it's come up in conversation, I would imagine that it doesn't have high ratings by most, which is the incomparable Grease 2. I love it in a way that is problematic for most. I love it. I love it. When people say, what's your favorite Michelle Pfeiffer movie? I'm like, not even close. Grease 2. I've seen Michelle Pfeiffer in Grease 2. Like, and I was like, oh my God, you guys, guess who else is in Scarface?
It's
Stephanie Zanoni from Grease 2.
I'm glad you brought up Grease 2 because I feel like there is some elitism with big Grease fans. Some of them really hate Grease 2, and I don't understand it because it's just two different flavors and they're both great.
They're so good. Adrian Smed, I mean, you guys, the gifts that keep on giving from that movie.
The reproduction song, yeah.
The parts of a flower are so constructed that very, very often the wind can cause pollination. See, I mean, I could go on and on, you guys, all day long.
Let's just save that clip to put this interview out. That's it right there. Done and done.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com and get up to 15% off your first purchase as a member with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for up to 15% off your first purchase as a member.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues. your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
So I used to work for Sydney Pollack, and it was a highlight of my career for many reasons, but one, because he told me something that continues to screw with my head. He basically said that he was only interested in making movies about two subjects, because they were the only two subjects that in all of human history we have no greater understanding than we did thousands of years ago. So he only likes to make movies about love and war, which I just thought was like a beautiful sentiment, and then in my darker nights, a more disturbing sentiment about the fact that we genuinely don't know more now than we did sort of at the beginning of human history. Yeah. But that sort of begat this question, which is, what is your favorite movie about love, and what is your favorite movie about war?
Oh, okay. So full disclosure, I don't watch a ton of war movies, you know.
Fair. We can clip that one out and just talk about love stories.
Yeah, no, well, 1917,
a very good movie.
Really reignited an interest of mine in telling stories about things that kind of scare me, like war. Mm. I kind of go in and out because the way my PTSD is set up, I kind of just go in and out of wanting to sort of dive into certain things that cause me terror, like war. But that movie was done so beautifully and shot so beautifully, and with these two sort of unknown actors that we all completely invested in their journey throughout this story. I love. So 1917. About love. Jeez. I hadn't really thought about it that way. Like, what movie about love do I love? I mean, it has to be something about like with that covers Black love. And the more I sort of read these think pieces about like Love Jones, maybe it's not as great of a love story. I mean, I don't know. It explores like the messy parts of love.
This is a video, but y'all did not see me burst into laughter at that mention. Mm. Yeah, because Love Jones was the movie at the time, and think pieces have definitely affected the way we look back at it.
Yeah, it's, you know, perhaps a little problematic. So I'd have to really, really rethink a lot of how I viewed a lot of the movies about love. Yeah, like Sounder. I don't know if you would have thought if you could think
that's
of that
a great answer.
Movie in terms of
I
love.
I love that but answer.
If we don't think of familial love when we think of love, and to me, there is nothing that says Black family more than Sounder and love.
I absolutely love that answer.
I love that movie.
Accepted. Moving forward. Okay.
Yeah, you've got a brand new resume item to add along with New York Times bestselling author and activist, and that is children's book author with Welcome to the Party.
Yes.
Yeah, inspired by the birth of your daughter, Kavya. Am I saying that correctly?
Yep, Kavya James.
Kavya James. How did the idea for Welcome to the Party spark within you, and was your writing process any different than from your essay collection, We're Gonna Need More Wine? Very different subject matter wise.
Wildly different storytelling. But I was approached by HarperCollins, who I already have a relationship with, after We're Gonna Need More Wine, to talk about a way of celebrating how families are created, being an ally to the LGBTQ plus community, having a mother that adopted three children after 60 years old, you know, having Kavya through IVF and then surrogacy, friends who are adopting, just knowing how families, you know, you have your chosen family, knowing how families are created, but they're not all celebrated in the same way. We don't have the space or the luxury to really celebrate all the ways that family is created. And I wanted to have a children's book that sort of touches on that. But yeah, children book writing is a whole other beast. It's like writing a long ass haiku, maybe. It's a challenge.
Well, in what way? What are the What are the limitations that like people don't think, what were the things that most surprised you about the process of writing a children's book where you were like, oh, I mean, let me just knock this out. How many words could it possibly be? Kids don't know that many words.
Well, that.
And then you were like, oh, wait.
Yeah. Kids don't know that many words.
I can only use 7 words.
Yeah. And then like the rhyming and the couplets and wanting to like, what's your macro? Like, what are we talking macro? And then figuring out the kinds of words that you can, should, could use to convey these larger themes to small children, was a challenge, a much more difficult challenge than making the decision to talk about putting yogurt in my vagina.
Fair enough. Fair enough.
I just liked all the head whips that you got. I just, now that I can see your face, yeah. Like, did she?
Well, yeah. You can see our faces, but when this airs,
No, there's a whole ass chapter, and we're going to need more wine, about, how to treat a DIY treatment for a vaginal issue that involves yogurt. Use plain, kids. Use plain.
Plain, no vanilla, no sugar, none of it.
Flavored, not going to be so fun for you guys.
This is a great way of getting into this question, which is that you've been so honest and upfront about talking about your journey to motherhood. And I think it's really inspiring because the media sort of presents one narrative around, you know, conception, pregnancy, motherhood, and that's sort of what we assume it is. But for many, many, many folks, that is not the case. What's been the most surprising thing about sharing that journey so candidly with the world?
I guess because when you're going through your own fertility journeys, it's a very isolating and lonely experience, mainly because most people don't share it with even the people that are closest to you. It's you, and if you have a significant other, it just really feels like y'all against the world. Or if you're doing it on your own, which so many of my friends are doing now, it's just wildly isolating. And we tend to not share it. We tend to not talk about it. We just kind of are like, and then a baby appeared. And everyone's like, yay, baby appeared. But you don't really get into the muck about how and how long and what that experience is like on you physically, mentally, emotionally, spiritually, financially, and certainly what that experience is like as a couple. And it's the reaction, on our book tour, I forget how many cities, a bunch of cities across the United States. And it felt like a revival. And the amount of women of every, race, ethnicity, age was a big one. I mean, women in their early 20s all the way up, talking about fertility, talking about adenomyosis, talking about maternal health was surprising, because during the process, it really feels very isolating, and you're sort of made to feel like you alone are defective. You alone, are a failure, when it is a very common experience.
So I want to talk a little bit more about your family, specifically my teenage hero, Zaya Wade. Like, I don't know that we can judge one's parents on the quality of the children, but if we can, you guys are doing an excellent job. And I'm just curious, I'm specifically interested in, like, how Zaya watches movies. Like, I know this is a very narrow question, but, like, when we talk, and how you think about what you let your kids watch and, like, what Kavi is going to watch and what that tells them about the world that they're coming up to into as Black women and as women who are going to be, outspoken about the reality of life as a Black woman. How do you guys have that conversation? How do you negotiate the media that comes into your home and the effect that it has?
Well, it's interesting that Zaya only, unless we force her, watches all content on her phone.
Like, I mean, she's a teenager.
Checks it's out.
What?
So yeah, some things are constant. Yeah, these things check
not,
out.
Not iPad, not laptop. Like, not the 1,001 TVs that we have here in this house, all on a tiny phone. And this phone is even big. Like, her phone is like this. And she watches whole seasons of Frasier and the New Girl. We have battles about the content that she watches often, but it's all on her phone, which, so if anyone is worried about Quibi, don't. There's a whole generation that is like, yes, perfect.
Ready to go.
But in terms of like what exactly that she's watching, she tends to be pretty open and honest because she watches in, you know, with in front of all of us, with all of us, about what she's watching and why she's watching it. Her love of Frasier is really her love of Lilith. And I was like, okay. Now, did I watch Frasier? Did I ever get into it? I don't think I've watched a whole episode of Frasier ever in life. But I understood why what Zaya is responding to and reacting to that she loves so much. The New Girl, which I've, you know, I've probably watched about three seasons of, I don't even know how many they've went, like nine or whatever. I understand why she's watched all of the seasons and now is on time number two. Yeah, she's rewatching it. There's something about independent, fiercely quirky, unapologetically offbeat, off-center, dynamic, complex, messy women that she relates to. We have had an ongoing battle about Friends versus living single and her love of Friends. And there's so many things that we're trying to address in terms of content that it's an easy way to discuss identity and race, gender, all of these intersections. It's not my job to tell my child who she should identify with and how and why, though I would like to.
Right. Because parents, yeah, you know, that's what parents, they do. Yeah.
But watching her find her way. And this last school year is the first year that she's had a ton of Black friends. Since, you know, our kids moved to LA, she's got a ton of Black friends. And that has actually, I've seen the shift in the content that she watches and then the commentary about that content. And it's changing slowly the more she's got friends that look like her, who also have big lives. I guess I don't recall having such big lives. These kids these days, I'm like, damn, these schedules are intense. Even in quarantine, y'all are booked to the hilt. This is fascinating. But
well, because she's only like 12,
she's
right?
12,
like
yeah. she's a 12 grade.
Here's the thing: I stand a Frasier watching 12-year-old. I identify with that. That is definitely. I was that weird kid. People were like, "What are you watching?" And I'm like, "I don't know. I just kind of like these people. They have smart conversations."
Yeah. But like, we all as a family, we watched Selah and the Spades last Friday night, opening night. So we had. You know, we got food and we had, you know, the whole family. Everyone was literally sitting watching Selah and the Spades. And it was like going to Magic Johnson Theater. My family, and this is why I watch things on the plane, they were talking and responding to the screen, what they were seeing on the screen. And it was so interesting that Zaya noticed how Lovey, I want to make sure I pronounce the lead girl's name, the girl who played Selah, how she was lit. She noticed the cinematography.
Well, for 12, her aesthetic sensibilities are pretty on point, just based on other things that I've seen, specifically y'all's debut fashion thing. Yeah. She's trying to figure it out.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, but it was like, because I was thinking it, but I'm like, my family doesn't care about, you know, cinematography. And then Zaya was like, she's lit so beautifully. We don't get to see, like, he's like, none of the things that I watch are lit. Like, the kids aren't lit like this. You don't see zits. And I was like, you don't see zits. And
shout.
And he was, and she was like, you know, the more I'm watching this girl be able to have zits and like imperfections, but she's still the girl. Was like,
shout out to Tyree Chapeau, writer and director of Selah and the Spades, and Jomo Frey, the cinematographer. Always good stuff.
Yeah,
it's crazy how those revelatory viewing experiences, particularly, I feel like when you're a teenager, it's like something snaps in your brain and you finally like understand a much bigger picture of everything that's been going on. Speaking of the bigger picture, activism has been such a key part of your role as a public figure. And whether that's bringing awareness to Black Lives Matter, to survivors of sexual assault, to reproductive healthcare issues, it's really impressive stuff. And it's the kind of thing that I think a lot of actors sort of tease at, but you're actually doing. How do you think that being a vocal champion for these causes has sort of impacted your life as an actor when so many other actors just don't engage at all?
I understand why people don't engage at all. Job security is a real thing, and needing that check to clear is what most of us do the jobs that we don't love and love. You know, it's kind of about, at the end of the day, we all have bills. And that understanding that something is happening that is problematic in the world, and then actually speaking on that in a public way without mincing words is terrifying. And there are real consequences. Anytime you stick your neck out, it can be the first one to get chopped off. And that's just the facts. And my experience, fortunately, unfortunately, certainly in the last year, there's a clear takeaway that I fear will not inspire more people to speak up. And I think that was the point of having me face, you know, me, oh my gosh, if Gab can, you know, lose out on opportunity for speaking up, and people would like to think I'm, you know, somebody who's decent and in reasonable standing in the world, if I can be so quickly and carelessly discarded for being very clear from day one about problematic issues, what hope do the rest of us have? And I think that was purposeful. And that's scary. And I get it. And it's not for everyone. It's not something to dip your toe in and run away. Either you're about that life or you're not. And for me, at this stage of my life, because a couple years ago, I couldn't have had the exact same conversation with the same tone, with the same confidence that I am today. What I realized today is I am not interested in being in the room. And I actually saw that on social media this morning. I think it was a line from the new Netflix movie that's coming up, or the Netflix show with Ryan Murphy. And it was like, it's you got to be in the room. And the reality is, for me, I don't want to be in a room where people don't want me there. I don't want to be in the room and expected to be quiet. I don't want to be in a room with people that have openly and actively worked to oppress me and people like me and other marginalized folks. I don't want to be the person always has to educate. I just sometimes want to go to work, and if in success and I want to build with people who are happy about that success, who want to make sure that that is normal and standard for all marginalized folks to be an active participant in the process. You have to be okay with wherever that leads. And at this stage of my career, and being, you know, full disclosure, I've squirreled away money. I've never lived based on what I can afford today. I've always lived like, if this all goes away and I got to figure out what I can do based on, you know, my sociology degree, you know, what can I afford? And with my husband being who he is and what he's created, you know, for himself and for the family, if I can't do it, shit, like, I have to. Like, I can't sleep if I don't. And what is the point? What is the point of making it? I'm using my finger quotes here. If not to make it better and easier for everybody else. So, you know, when I created my production company, it wasn't another arm to create wealth for myself. It was, if I got my foot, like even if it's just my pinky toe in the door, I have to hold it open. I got to figure out what else I can drag to keep, you know, to prop up that door open. And I hope the activism can be married into content creating and creating more opportunities. Because really, what the fuck is it about if we're not all at least trying to win together? I've been in those rooms. I am not the happy Negro that's like, I made it! And nobody else is there that looks like me. And it's not a fun place to be. And I don't know why people want to be the magical Negro. I'm not the one who gets geeked about being
you
chosen
know why.
Person. Well, you know I know why.
It comes with a check. It comes with a check.
But after a while, it doesn't feel good being cashing that check, and then you're still stuck with them.
Completely agree. So this is my
and they
my
still don't fuck with you like at
right.
all.
So this is my follow up question, sort of on that tip. When did you decide you were about that life? Because look, even talking about Bring It On, you went in with a plan for like how to manage a situation that you saw as problematic. And then you yourself said, I wasn't about that life the entire time, but now I am. Like, was there a moment that sort of preceded some event where you had to step up and do it? Like when did you sort of decide, like, you sort of looked around and said, you know what? If it's not me, who else is it going to be? Like I know when that moment happened for me, and I struggle to live up to it on a day-to-day basis. But like was there a event, a sort of Kairos moment, as Cornel West talks about?
Race matters. Thank you, Franklin.
I mean, you know, taking it back to the sociology degree.
I'd love it. I've had a series of these, you know, as Oprah would say, aha moments, but because they keep happening, it just feels like, listen, listen, bitch. Like, I don't know how many other ways I can show you before you get it. So I talk about in when I first got divorced and my show got canceled. And, you know, when every time you reach rock bottom and you're like, okay, this is rock bottom. How am I going to rise from this? Every time I hit rock bottom, I'm faced with this. A, are you going to talk about hitting rock bottom? You're going to talk about how you got to bottom, how you got up from the bottom. And every time I'm like, if I'm totally honest in these moments, I'm at risk. And to what end? You know, to what end? Yeah. Am I narking on myself for a greater good or to like entertain with my tea? And there's a difference in that, mm-hmm. You know? And then something else will happen in my life where I'm like, now this is rock bottom. I'm never gonna pull myself up out of this. And I've just had those over my life. And a couple years ago, probably like right around the time of We're Gonna Need More Wine, the book tour. And even with that, like there's, I don't know, a good 10 chapters I didn't include because I wasn't prepared to talk about them openly and honestly and be super transparent about those parts of my life, because we all know how media works. You could say 1,000 things. There could be the cure for cancer, you know, all these amazing things. And then one salacious thing, that's all they're going to talk about. Yep. And I wasn't willing to let certain parts of my life overtake the larger, bigger issues that I wanted to address. But on that book tour, and people started asking me questions about things that weren't in the book. And I had those moments of like, oh, fuck, why did I say they could ask anything? And I could either fall back on some super cliche shit that they expect of us in Hollywood, or I could tell the truth and actually hopefully change some lives with transparency or through transparency. And when I started to think, you kind of go into, what do I have to lose? And when it comes time to being about that life, what I have to lose at this point is my soul, and I'm not willing to trade my soul for a check. And I can't say that I wouldn't have done it differently a couple years ago. You know, we all have a line in the sand, and that line in the sand can change every day. That's why, like, you know, I was tweeting about it this morning, but watching the documentary about, you know, the Bulls.
The Last Dance.
The Last Dance and Scottie's contract. And that feeling.
Same.
That feeling of, I know what my value is. I know what I bring to the table, but I also know how many other people I have to be personally responsible for. So for a lot of marginalized folks, a contract is never just a contract. It's the hope and the promise of better for not just yourself, but all of these other people, a whole community, if you will, beyond family. So it's the same. It's like, do you do what's do you do the right thing? And sometimes the right thing is believing yourself and letting the chips fall where they may. And sometimes it's the security of a steady check, which is why I understand that being about this life and speaking up is not for everybody. And it's not always been for me. And I can't say that, you know, in an hour, I might have to make a decision that goes into protecting all of the people I am financially responsible for versus the greater good of the world. You know, it's, you have to make this decision every day. And it's a fucking tough one, but so is sleep. And I can't sleep when I know I haven't done the right thing. And that if me just speaking up can change even a little something for one person, who I am today, I can't sleep. I can't move through the world knowing I've been called to do something and I'm not. I'm willfully not. I'm openly, knowingly not. You're just an asshole at that point for me.
As you're sort of entering this new phase of your career where you're letting decisions be guided by, you know, sort of more than the traditional things we think about in Hollywood when it comes to taking a part, is there anything that you have not had a chance to do that yet in terms of acting that you haven't been given the opportunity to do? I mean, you're quite a Renaissance woman, but I'm very curious if there are worlds you have not gotten a chance to play in yet.
Horror? Never done like a horror film. I remember years ago, I went in and read for like a lot. What I hope at least Neil ended up getting it, but I think I forget which Scream it was, where they had a black, but I didn't get it. And I don't know if that one audition has just been like, well, you know, she's not good in the horror space. So I've never gotten to do horror. I've never, there's a lot of things, most things that you see, you know, actors get to play. They see you as one thing and that's kind of what it is. Now, being seen as a girl next door, is that the worst thing? No. Is it kind of boring? Sometimes. A leader, somebody who's uncompromising. I mean, listen, it could be a lot worse things that I've sort of been pigeonholed in, but
right.
There's a lot that I haven't gotten to play. And, you know, we just finished season 2 of LA's Finest, and asking for more layers and more mess and more complexity and, you know, don't feel like you have to be beholden to a brand. I'd love to see where the writers' like wildest imaginations can go and then try, you know, like, I will admit there have been times I have been tasked with solid material that I just failed. I just wasn't good at. So I have to kind of be accountable for also like some of the limitations and how people see me and my work. I haven't always been good. I haven't always been prepared. There was that one time I was fired off of the Cleveland show. I mean, to be fired off of a Voice was a different kind of low. But again, you know, taking, you know, being accountable for myself. And I'd like to think that now, hopefully people see that I'm recommitted to doing a good job and wanting to do different things. And I'm hoping that we can sort of redefine ingenue as a girl with a, you know, get a little bit more seasoning, a little more Tony Chacha Ray on the resume, and give me a chance to have a do-over. Or 10.
All right. So we have two final questions. Okay. And these are sort of the ones we ask everybody. What is the single image from a film that has stayed with you the longest or had the most like impact? And that doesn't have to be like a single like still image. It can be a moment or a cut or like the introduction of a score. Like, but like what's when you think of movies, what's the like that moment?
It's, I mean, just to be perfectly honest, it was probably like Judy Garland in Meet Me in St. Louis, where she's sort of, you know, kind of hanging off the trolley car. It's one of my sister's favorite movies that she watched nonstop growing up. And I always just thought of that as what filmmaking is supposed to be. Now, of course, after watching Judy, I'm like, oh, God, poor Judy. It wasn't all moonlight and roses. But it just felt like, oh, that's what it's like, you know, just wanting that experience as a Hollywood, you know, actress. Cut to, I actually got that experience. I didn't realize, you know, it's the beauty of the shot without the reality of the moment, if that makes any sense. And that's probably why it sticks out to me the most now.
I'm going to bring it home with our final question that we also ask everybody. And that question is, if you could do a simultaneous film screening for every person on planet Earth to watch one movie, we're going to ignore time zones and any kind of Wi-Fi streaming issues. What movie would you pick to show the entirety of humanity?
Oh, gosh. Grease.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think we already know the answer to that. Yeah.
Yeah, Grease. Yeah.
Perfect.
Yep. Gabrielle. From the Hollywood Bowl with the Bowl Orchestra. Yes.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
From Luminary, the Blacklist podcast is a production of The Blacklist and Ninth Planet Audio. Our executive producers are Franklin Leonard, Kate Hagen, Han Zani, and Jimmy Miller. Gabrielle Horton is our lead producer. Nicholas Pertel composed our theme music, and this episode was edited and mixed by Kevin Liu. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at thathagengirl, thathagengirl. You can find Franklin on Twitter at Franklin Leonard and on Instagram at Franklin J. Leonard. And you can find The Blacklist on both Twitter and Instagram at The Blacklist, thebblklst.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.